Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithful sisters, and welcome to episode 136 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Simon.
And joining us today is, well, it would almost be understating the matter to call him a mere friend of the show. It's uncle of this podcast and spinster of this parish, Mr. Simon Brett.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Simon, of course, is one of the famous trio who used to compete to get a word in edgeways on the old Blue Box podcast, which used to count among its regular listeners and correspondents the Diddly Dummers themselves, and as a way of stopping us from writing into their show.
Until the embargo.
They urged us to start our own podcast, and the rest, as they say, is history. Not Simon's first visit to us. He first visited us in just doing some research today, August 2014.
Was it really?
On podcast number 17, in the glory days of the Whosium, when our guests didn't just traipse in with one measly exhibit to put on display, but had came with a whole armful. Simon presented us with, can you remember, Simon?
It's putting him on the spot rather, isn't it?
God, I remember doing a heartfelt speech about the BBC.
Yeah. A BBC television licence.
That's right, that's right, yep. I don't know whether I'd still have the same opinion, if I'm honest, but yeah, go on.
The 20th anniversary Radio Times special.
Oh yeah, good choice.
A programme from Funnycon 2013.
Yes.
And a life-sized effigy of Nicola Bryant.
Oh, well, I never. I was in a funny place. If I remember rightly, I was between moving houses. We'd sold one house. My wife's parents had passed away within 6 months of each other, without bringing a downer on the podcast. They'd passed away, and so we end up selling my wife's house and then moving into their house, which is where I did the podcast, and then we finally moved to where I am now. So that was a weird place, very odd place to be emotionally and psychologically. So, you know, if you've got any issues with that episode, then I do apologise.
So to confound matters, you were then asked to go on a little known podcast as well. It's funny what you say about the Nicola Bryant effigy, because that's actually the reason why the Rev and Al left, is because where we discovered it. But anyway, there you go.
Al!
Well, one of them brought in... Oh, who did they bring in? Actually, it wasn't an effigy. It was the the actual... A deep frozen body of, wasn't it? Oh, it was Johnny Lumley, that was it, wasn't it?
Deep frozen?
Well, sort of in the sense of...
cryogenic.
She's in a suspended animation capsule.
Oh, I see.
Somewhere in aisle 47 in the Whosium.
She's going to be livid when she finds out.
Yes, a Whosium appearance from Simon, notable mainly for the outraged letters which we received afterwards from the solicitors for the estate of Carmine Infantino.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Worst Star Wars artist ever.
I know. It's bad, isn't it? Since then, I've done my homework on Carmine Infantino and the influence he had on comics back in the day. And he is seen as kind of, in some people's eyes, second only to Jack Kirby. So, yeah, I probably did upset a few people.
And then 2 years after that, Simon returned on podcast 60 for about 15 minutes to plug his the Seasons of Time book. And Simon also has another connection with the Diddly Dum podcast, of course, because he's, being a bit of an artist, he's also been one of our own occasional house artists. If you pop over to the Diddly Dum homepage on Facebook, you'll see us. We've reinstated the Time Lords of Many Nations header, which Simon drew for Hayden's Podcasters Assemble podcast.
Mm. Yes.
Podcast 37 back in 2015.
36? Mm. That's nearly 100 podcasts ago. That's 99 podcasts ago. Good Lord.
He also replicated for us the Rev's original Diddly-Dum logo in a PDF format, which enables us to change its colours and use it as a watermark. Photoshopping abilities which were still beyond me when the Rev left us, and so I never got to ask him to do it. Talking of artwork, Simon, whatever happened to Cygnus Alpha?
It kind of petered out. If I remember rightly, I didn't have time to do the last issue, so Lee came in as editor on that, and he did it extremely quickly, and then we didn't sell many copies, so all the money we'd built up from previous issues went on that last issue.
Oh dear.
But the other thing that happened was, of course, was they started doing these Blake 7 events called Cygnus Alpha. So we felt,
of course, yes.
Yeah, which, you know, and a little part of me sort of thought, well, so Cygnus Alpha's been running since like 1984, coincidentally with what I'm going to be talking about today. It started in 1984, and so that's been going a lot longer. Although, you know, to be fair, Cygnus Alpha is a Blake 7 episode. I never did find out why a Doctor Who zine was named after a Blake 7 episode. It's a bit...
Oh, yeah, that's rather rum.
Now, before we start getting into anything, this podcast, listeners, marks a very special milestone in the grim farrago. sorry, the joyous cavalcade that is the Diddly Dum podcast. Could you tell the kitchen staff that we're ready now, please, computer? Yes, listeners, we come now to the real reason why Simon's visiting us today. You'll probably have read of the mysterious nationwide shortage of cake candles recently. Well, we put our agents onto the case, and they discovered that no less a person than Mr. J.R. Southall himself began panic buying toilet rolls and cake candles as soon as the lockdown began.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I'm not surprised, to be honest.
So, why are these strangers in space? Which I'm sure also to mention, by the way, is Simon's latest podcast, resurrected from the Blue Box podcast. While these strangers in space were recording their most recent podcast, we got Simon to slip out of the house during one of those periods when he couldn't get a word in edgeways and secure us a number of packets of cake candles from JR's stash. And he even managed to slip back into the room while JR was still on the same sentence and hadn't noticed his absence. And even as I speak, the Hoosium's kitchen robots are bringing through something they've been working on all week.
Ooh.
James, that is a big one.
It's a cake. Ablaze with 75 of JR's ill-gotten candles.
He will notice, just so you know. You can nick one and he would notice.
We are celebrating today our own Mark's 75th appearance.
You remembered.
On the Diddly Dum podcast. And this is not only his 75th podcast, but entirely by coincidence, we're recording this on the 9th of July, which is also the 4th anniversary of Mark's first appearance.
Good Lord.
On the podcast. Back in...
Precision timing.
Oh, I had it written down somewhere. I think I've lost it.
2016, wasn't it?
Mm.
Back in 4 years. Oh, it must be, wouldn't it? 4 years. 2020. Podcast 60 wasn't it?
It's the one good thing about 2020 is it's easy to do sums with it, isn't it?
Well, you'd have thought, but not then. Yeah.
That's why it's not like Doc needs maths for his job or anything.
It really looks delicious, doesn't it? What's the cake made of, please, Senior Chef Robot?
Bread crumbs and butter beans.
Oh. Oh, very nice.
Mm.
It's an acquired taste, isn't it?
Leave this bit here.
We first encountered Mark when you wrote into the podcast with a letter, which at the time, I remember being a little unsure of. I was thinking, was he being bitchy? Well, I thought we'd mark Mark's anniversary by reading it out for the first time, shall we?
No! No, don't! No!
Dear diddly men.
Oh, God. Oh.
I just wanted to say... Are you serious?
Oh, I feel terribly embarrassed because it was like 4 years ago.
Dear diddly men, I just wanted to say how much I enjoy Hayden's impersonations. By far my favourite is one of his non-Who related ones.
Hayden's not going to speak to me for the rest of the podcast.
As wonderful as his Terence Dix is, the one that I find most devastatingly accurate and amusing is the one he does of Mark Williams' smug, self-satisfied boaster character from the first show. I particularly like the way he leaves off the punchline at the end so the listener at home can have the pleasure of saying out loud while listening to the podcast. For example, then I said to legendary artist Chris Achilleos, that's a nice picture, and he took it off his wall, signed it and gave it to me. All together now, which was nice. Or from the convention podcast. Even though I had no money, I still got into the convention where I was introduced to and had a personal audience with legendary producer Philip Hinchcliffe. 1, 2, 3.
Which was nice.
Although I do think the latter would perhaps have been improved by Hayden being given the original tapes of Ark in Space at the end. That convention podcast in particular was crammed full of these comedy treats. So much so, in fact, that my fellow passengers started regarding me rather strangely on my train journey into London, as I proclaimed, which was nice, every 5 minutes. This week's podcast, now this must have been, because it's 4 years ago, isn't it? This week's podcast was something of a letdown at first, as I found the Peter Purvis anecdote to be lacking in jamminess and grandeur. However, Hayden has soon redeemed himself with his tale of appearing not once, but twice, in the Five-ish Doctor's anniversary special.
Oh yeah, I was in that.
Thus enabling me to joyously belt out, which was nice. Thanks for putting out such a genuinely enjoyable podcast. We didn't mind that bit. All the best, Mark.
Simon, could you tell Mark that I don't want to speak to him again?
Am I the go-between now? Am I the mediator, as they call it?
You're the time mediator.
What can I say? I was just like, God, he's so jammy all the time. I just thought, I've got to get this off my chest. So I did.
While I was researching this information, I noticed on your very first podcast, Mark, Podcast 60, we ended it with...
Hayden's top.
The top 20 countdown of the top 15 jammy Hayden anecdotes, while Mark sort of groaned and howled in the background.
Yes, yes, I remember.
Top three now. In at number three, it's Cider with Terry. Terrence Dix turns round at a bar, says hello to Hayden, and asks if he'd like a pint, and buys him a cider. At number two, it's Hayden turning up for dinner and found he is, not only that his table had been pinched by Deborah Watling, but that he, as a result, he had to move to sit on the table with Chris Achilleos and Trevor Martin, and ended up speaking throughout the whole meal with them about their love of Pink Floyd. And in at number one, it's Hayden's outrageous photobombing cameos in the Five-ish Doctors special, when he not only appears in the photo of Peter Davison drawing up in his car outside a convention hotel, but is actually lining up for his autograph in the hotel later.
You lucky bastard! They must think the sun shines out of your eyes.
Anyway, I couldn't work out whether this was actually meant to be a dig at Hayden, saying, oh, he's such a boaster, whether it was just a subtle irony.
Oh no, it's not that he's a boaster, it's just purely that he's jamming.
And so I ended up persuading Mark to rewrite it before I read it out. We got chatting, and we ended up inviting Mark onto the podcast, and the rest is history. How's the experience been for you, Mark, the last 65 podcasts?
75.
Sorry, 75.
Never think you worked with figures all day long, would you? it's been fantastic, to be honest. I don't know if I've said on the podcast before, but I was going through a bit of a bad patch myself at one point, and in fact, not a few months before I joined the podcast, my mentor, who I had at the time, they weren't strictly a counsellor, sort of a mentor, as I was having mental health problems, and she said to make a bucket list of things that I'd like to do, not necessarily outrageous things like swimming with dolphins in...
Jelly?
in jelly, yeah. Thank you. That's exactly the substance I was looking for. And funny enough, I did write down, because at the time I was mad keen on Doctor Who podcasts and I'd started listening to quite a few. And I said that one of the things on my bucket list would be to appear on a Doctor Who podcast. And within a few short months, there I was appearing. Being very grateful as well, because it's given me an opportunity to do stuff that I'd never done before. Like, I'm not so sure I'd have visited any conventions. I certainly wouldn't have got to be brushed off by Peter Purvis for being a West Ham fan. And just some of the social things we've done outside of it as well, meeting up, you know, down to Hayden's wedding. It's all just come from the podcast. And it's all been... So it's as John Le Mesurier famously ultimately said, it's all been rather lovely.
Well, it's been all been rather lovely being with you, Mark.
Oh.
By the way, Mark, Lorraine, the barmaid at our local pub, the Whisk and Plunger, has asked us to save her a piece of cake.
Oh.
She'll be popping around to the back door of the kitchen later to pick it up, so don't scoff it all, please, boys. Can someone save her a slice, please? Well, having got the ceremonial side of things over and done with, let's turn to the theme of this podcast, which is comics. Comics and comic strips of all types that we've enjoyed down the years, but mainly Doctor Who-related ones.
Well, comics got a good mention on my very first appearance, I believe. I think I mentioned Rogue Trooper and a couple of Marvel Doctor Who crossovers.
I'm just looking at the records of that podcast. Rogue Trooper cosplay.
Have I got this all wrong this week, lads? When you said comics, I've just watched 10 series of The Two Ronnies. Rogue Trooper cosplay.
That was someone dressed in blue at the Sci-Fi by the Sea convention, wasn't it?
Well, they were dressed as Rogue Troopers.
Oh, that was it. Mark's debut podcast, of course, involved him making presentations to the Whoseum. One of the things he presented was Marvel's Uncanny X-Men comic. Number 218.
Yes, it is.
It was also about Dave Gibbons. Then Doctor Hooves. Doctor Who and My Little Pony crossovers.
Yes.
Marvel Excalibur 1998, The Cross Time Caper.
Oh, God, yes. That is a comic.
Yeah, it's a brilliant comic. And also, it features a character who's a doctor who works for WHO, I believe. Not the World Health Organization. It stands for something else, doesn't it? And he's got the ability to travel through time. And weirdly, considering it was 1998, he's dressed almost exactly as David Tennant's doctor. And he's Scottish, which is both right and wrong.
What year did this one come out, Mark?
1998.
Oh, that's weird. I've never heard of that before.
Oh, it was earlier than that, wasn't it? It was late 80s.
Oh, yeah, it probably is.
It was late, yeah, I was at college.
Yeah, why have you got down as 98? Yes, it must be. No, I think, yes, you're right. Because it was Simon Davis, isn't it? And
that's right. So you made me question myself then.
No, that's right. I've just taken what Doc said as being fact without thinking about it.
That seems an entirely reasonable thing to do.
Which I'm sure comes from some sort of post-hypnotic suggestion. That kicks in every time he says hello, faithless listener. But yeah, it's a spin-off from the X-Men, Hayden, with Captain Britain, Nightcrawler, Kitty Pryde, and others.
And others.
It's very good, though.
Yeah, Lockjaw. Is it Lockjaw? No, not Lockjaw. What's he called, the dragon? Lockheed.
Lockheed, yes.
Right, so how do we want to do this? Well, I think most of us, in fact, all of the four of us, the main source of Doctor Who comic strips that we would have come across would have been in the various versions of Doctor Who Weekly, Doctor Who Monthly, Doctor Who Magazine that had come out. Was it only Mark and I who were around to actually buy issue one of Doctor Who Weekly?
I didn't get issue one of Doctor Who Weekly.
So is it only me?
Yeah, I got it. I still have it and I still get annoyed with how badly I put the transfers into the thing in the middle.
I had a small orange Anglepoise lamp that used to stand on my bedside table, and I put the, for lack of putting it anywhere else to do, I put those transfers. It was a spaceship, wasn't there? There was the Doctor running with his scarf flying. Was there a dinosaur? I put them on the base of this lamp, and then a couple of years ago I went back to Manchester to find that my dad, in a fit of cleanliness, had taken sandpaper to it and repainted it. I was absolutely furious.
There was a period of time when everything I owned was covered in the Star Wars transfers used to get in shreddies.
I've got a chest of drawers in my bedroom, which is still covered with Cartoon Network ones. So stuff like the Flintstones and Top Cat. I can never quite get them off. So it's still got like that weird sticky residue around the outline of Dick Dastardly and Muttley and that kind of thing.
I get that. So the furniture in my bedroom still got this weird sticky residue on it, and I can't think of it.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
Well, we thought that what we tried to do, this may not...
Well, it keeps your duvet up when you wake up in the morning, doesn't it?
We may not...
Lift up the duvet and it sticks to the wall. Fantastic.
This may not work as smoothly as it sounds in the planning stage. But what we're thinking of doing is each of us taking a particular Doctor's era from those comic strips and having a little word about them, perhaps picking from those a particular story that we like especially, and then the rest of us piling in. And hopefully, in between those, we may well hear the sound of Rassilon's horn, which will be the sign for one of us to make a bit of a break in the proceedings by talking about a non-Doctor Who related comic or comic strip. So what I thought, I'll go with the Fourth Doctor, because I think I abandoned Doctor Who Weekly Monthly earlier than the rest of you did. And so it was a case of either that or rereading them all. Although I have to confess, within the last few days, I've been through the whole Peter Davison run of comics and the whole of, should we say, about a third of Collins. I have to confess to... was it the very first issue that began the Iron Legion?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember being absolutely gobsmacked, even just by that big full-page frame of the robot legionaries marching through this little village. And it's one of those things where I think you think... I think it's one of the things that made me keep at Doctor Who Weekly. I thought, oh, this is something classy, this. I wasn't particularly interested in, although it was still the pre-internet days, I wasn't particularly interested in, you know, little fact files on what Zygons were, things like that. I think I actually bought Doctor Who Weekly mainly for the comic strip in those days, which ironically, it's ironic because now I buy it and the comic strip is usually the one thing I don't bother reading. It no longer interests me in this day and age.
At this point, you were already an avid 2000 AD reader, weren't you? Were you or were you not?
Yes, 79. It would have been going for 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing that attracted me to it, because the first, five or six stories in the Tom Baker era of these strips were written by Pat Nils and John Wagner, and drawn by by Dave Gibbons, Big E himself. I think that I must have been thinking, oh, it looks similar to some 2000 AD strips in many ways, which is possibly what attracted me to it. I was going to talk about Iron Legion, but I thought, the artwork aside, there wasn't really that much to the story beyond the basic concept of Roman Empire in space that particularly tickled my fancy. So I'm going to choose instead the Star Beast, which started at issue 19.
See, this is where I came in.
Right. Still from that glorious early era of Dave Gibbons' artwork. And rereading this story this week for the first time in yonks made me think for the first time that in several ways this is, if not a precursor to some of more modern Doctor Who, that's probably being going up completely over the top, and at least laying some new ground, because the Earth action takes place in an industrial town among steel mills. You know, instead of a little colourful suburbia, as you might have had in TV comic previously, instead of having the Doctor's grandchildren, John and Gillian, we get proper teenagers. Sharon and Fudge. With that sort of insulting banter that we rather imagine that teenagers do. Oh, you're a weirdo. Oh, shit, whatever.
I was going to say that's not as colourful as the things I said as a teenager, but you know, you can only print so much in DWM.
I did say it's probably closer to a teenager than the way they had Ace talking.
Oh, yeah. Like toe rag, bilge bag. Like later Doctor Who, the boy is the dick and the girl is the smart one. And, of course, but I'd almost forgotten this, the character of Sharon is black. Mm. Which I imagine is a first, given that she goes on to travel with the Doctor briefly. And, of course, we get the counterintuitive idea of the cute and cuddly alien actually being the baddie, and the ugly, dark, spiky aliens being the goodies.
Goody, goody, yum, yum.
Though, to be fair, these Roth warriors do start by planting a bomb inside the Doctor, so it's not
well, entirely... Well, yeah, it's, you can't blame us for thinking yeah. they were baddies.
What did we think of the Fourth Doctor's era, from what we can remember of it?
Oh, well, this is one of my favourite eras. Dave Gibbons is such an absolute class act. And it was, this is probably about the same time I just got into 2000 AD. Wasn't into 2000 AD right at the start. So it's probably around about 1980. I think I started buying that. But it just looks so exciting. I do remember one of the most exciting things I ever saw, actually, was the advert for the collected Iron Legion that they have later on in Doctor Who. I don't know if it's monthly or weekly, where they collected the series all together into one book that you could buy for like 45p from newsagents. And the cover of that, which had little clips of the artwork, like it had the robots on the flying motorbikes, and it had that robot who's been hit by the metal fatigue gun and he's sort of all falling apart, but trying to shoot. Anyway, it just looks like one of the most exciting covers ever. But yeah, it was slightly disappointing when I read it. But it is very 2000 AD. I don't think there's a lot of depth to the stories. There's a lot of sort of very Judge Dredd style humour, which you'd expect, especially in the John Wagner written episodes. Because Pat Mills would write one story, although they'd both be credited, and then John Wagner would write the next story, and they'd take it in turns like that. And whoever's name was first in the credits is the one who'd actually scripted the story.
I thought it was... I didn't read it. I've never read it. But just reading the notes here. The warriors attack K-9, making him useless, it says here on the fact file about it. Yeah. There's some kind of thought process going on here, isn't there? That they get into a format where they don't have to worry about whether he can travel on any surface or anything like that. They just want to get rid of him.
Yeah, because he's also super useful in these stories, K-9, because he can take out Daleks and everything.
I imagine the artist would probably say to the writer, do you know what, he's a pain in the ass to draw, so can you get rid of him out of the story?
Didn't Dave Gibbons say on one of the Strip for Action documentaries that he used to get the proportion of K-9 all wrong? So there'd be panels where you've got the Fourth Doctor carrying K-9 under his arm, like he's a loaf of bread. You know, and obviously it was significantly bigger than that.
Obviously what inspired the radio-controlled K-9 that came out a few years ago, because that's about the size of a loaf of bread, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, he didn't like drawing the Daleks much either, did he? I don't think, Dave Gibbons.
It's not a nice thing. It really isn't. Unless you're really that kind of technically minded, they are horrible to draw.
Yeah, especially like several of them in one frame as well, isn't it? You know, having to just keep drawing all those straight lines and those stupid balls. It must just be awful.
Well, Lee Sullivan, who we'll get to later on, is a big fan of drawing Daleks. He's probably the only one who enjoys doing it.
Oh.
A baby Dalek.
I when I purchased, what's the Philip Haynes book, 25 Glorious Years?
Yeah.
I purchased that at the indoor market in Cardiff city centre from a second-hand bookstall in there. And it's packed full. It's got about 60 autographs in it. And on the plain sort of flyleaf inside, Lee Sullivan has drawn Sylvester McCoy in there and signed it.
Beautiful.
So that was my jamminess. But that was like 30 years ago. So.
You found a second-hand shop or something?
Yes, yeah, I did. It's £20. It's got dozens of autographs in it.
Simon, you said like you liked Dave Gibbons at one point, didn't you?
It's interesting that you use the word classy, and a couple of you have used the word class. He is just a really classy artist, isn't he?
Mm.
A clartist. Yeah, going right through to things like Watchmen and things like that. Oh, I mean, he's probably second only to Brian Bolland in kind of the, for me, the greatest 2000 AD artists. Although I do adore Alan Davis. I suppose he's classed as 2000 AD as well. But, but I mean, for me, this black and white artwork, what I loved about the Marvel UK comics, even the reprints of the American stuff, was that they would reprint them in black and white and maybe use a bit of shading Letraset here and there rather than colour. Because, I mean, it was obviously for cost, wasn't it, to keep the cost down of the printing. And that's what's beautiful about these early Doctor Who strips.
On that note, regarding the colour, I did get a whole bunch of the American reprints. Is it Marvel Premiere?
Yeah.
Possibly. And every frame was colourised in whatever, whoever happened to be in the office that day decided that colour corridor should be and stuff, and what colour canine should be. It was just a bit, I mean, it wasn't a complete disaster, but it's not good. It looks wrong in black and white. I'm sorry, it looks wrong in colour.
Yeah.
I was quite a fan of Brian Bolland's as well. I think they are.
Oh, huge.
They're not dissimilar. And I think what's in that came up, I was watching on the strip for Action. This is the era specific extras on DVDs, listeners. About Doctor Who comic strips, was someone mentioned what a good draftsman Dave Gibbons was, and that rang a bell with me because I don't know if it makes me sound slightly naive and uncool, but I do like to know what I'm looking at. If you know what I mean, I do like it to be quite clear, as opposed to, I mean, there are some artists that come in and it's okay, but it's not. I don't draw. I've said several times on this podcast that I'm always quite jealous of people like Simon and the Rev, and I will stop listing people because I'll probably forget someone who can draw properly. But from that position, it may sound quite, you know, naive of me, unsophisticated of me, but it looks like someone who I would think, oh, so-and-so can draw properly. And I'll just leave that one. I feel too guilty about saying that.
Can I just ask, are you thinking about people like Mick McMahon, or Mike McMahon as he used to be known, but then it turned out that they just misheard him, and so all his 2000 AD credits and Doctor Who magazine credits are all to Mike McMahon, which is in fact his name's Mick. Do you mean him? He's the one who did Junkyard Demon. He's very much more stylized.
Oh, really? I was thinking that...
Done Judge Dredd and stuff as well.
I mean, I seem to remember Mick McMahon's Judge Dredds were, rather than sort of the clean-cut lantern jaw, it was always looked as if he'd had a shave that morning.
Yeah, and very blocky and bulky. I used to think, I love Mick McMahon, I think his work's great.
That's what's strange about me liking Junkyard Demon. It goes completely against the fact that I like very clean, like you say, draftsman-like
clean
artwork.
That's the word I'm looking for, yeah.
Which is why I love people like Brian Bolland. But Junkyard Demon goes completely against that. And it's stylized to the point where it almost looks amorphous, doesn't it? It's quite organic looking.
Yes, it is. But I think things look like they've got real weight in it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's possibly because he draws feet so big, but...
For instance, in Junkyard Demon, isn't the Cyberman he draws a Mondasian Cyberman? Whereas you'd imagine if Dave Gibbons was doing it, he might probably do a Revenge of the Cybermen style.
It's a Mondasian Cyberman head on a Tomb of the Cybermen body.
Oh, God.
I think.
I should have brought this up, should I?
You know.
But it works, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does work. And also, I think it was a mistake. I think they'd asked him to do the Mark I Cyberman, if you like, because they wanted to show that the Doctor travelled through time. And they said, yeah, let's use a Mark I Cyberman. But he gave it the wrong body, which they didn't realise. But I think actually that works quite well with the story because it's a junkyard. So it's kind of a bit like the guy at the end of last season, the Cyberman from that, whose name I've completely forgotten, with his face half off and different bits.
Dave,
yeah, Cyber Dave from The Haunting of Villa Diodato.
Of course, you had the backup strips as well, though, didn't you? Because you had things like Throwback the Soul of a Cyberman. So you had David Lloyd.
Yeah.
He's another great artist.
Yeah.
David who, sorry?
David Lloyd, who drew V for Vendetta as well. And, but like you say, that was a Revenge era, or was it Invasion era Cyberman? I can't remember.
Or Croton.
Well, I don't.
Yes.
He's like a slightly new type of Cyberman, isn't he?
Ashad.
Yes, it was Ashad was the one that, from Villa Diodati, thank you, yeah. Yeah, Croton, the Cyberman, now, he's, I think he's a new type, isn't he, with a kind of sort of slightly thinner look.
He had the head from Revenge, and I always thought the body, because he had the chest unit, which looked like it was from Wheel in Space and the Invasion era Cybermen there.
Yeah.
It was like a sort of bits put together, because, of course, Croton, I'd like to bring up later, but I just want to say just something about Star Beast first, is that I started buying DWM. Actually, I didn't start buying DWM. My parents bought it for me initially, and it would have been 1996, so it was around the time of the TV movie. And in the lead up to Christmas that year, I hadn't really taken much of an interest in the comic at that point, because I was 7 years old, and the comics I read were all in colour. And there was a bit of a bias, I feel, in the 90s towards black and white things being a little bit naff because they weren't in colour.
Oh, well, I think that's kind of common amongst kids, though, isn't it, as well?
So I got I went to the newsagents, and they had the Doctor Who yearbook for the previous year, which was the 1996 one. That was in the lead-up to the TV movie. And there were a couple of sort of throwback sequels to earlier comic strips from the Dave Gibbons and Mills and Wagner era, and one of them was Star Beast 2, and the other one was Junkyard Demon 2. And the Star Beast 2 one I really, really enjoyed, because you kind of got a feel from it that this was something which, again, we talk about, you know, it's kind of the same principle as the Dravins, isn't it, from Galaxy 4, you know, something which looks cute and pretty isn't going to be nasty, and then ends up, you know, turning into a huge, furry, no, I'm not going to say that. Because it's going to sound wrong, whichever way I put it. But, you know, but Beep the Meep is... He's a big furry ball, yeah. He ends up becoming trapped in a Lassie film after the Doctor and Fudge encounter him in a cinema.
I don't think I've read this.
It's slightly mad, but
is all news to me.
But I rather enjoyed it. It was only released in the Doctor Who yearbook 96.
I wasn't aware of this.
And then Junkyard Demon 2 had a character in it which was called Shane Love McJoy, I think it was. It's an amalgamation of Ian McShane and Lovejoy, I think, yeah, the character was in that one, with, again, Cybermen.
I've just got to correct myself. I got the artist wrong. Steve Dillon did Throwback.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
But David Lloyd did the... I can't remember what it's called. Oh, the stuff where they introduced the special executive and all that stuff.
Yes.
The crossover stuff.
Black
Sun Rising?
Yes.
Is that it? Yeah.
It's certainly something to do with Black Suns. Yeah, and he did quite a lot of the other ones, didn't he? I think he did Business as Usual, which is the Auton one.
Yeah.
Which is really good as well. That's written by Alan Moore.
Yeah.
Alan Moore being one of my favourite comic book writers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably of all time. I think one Alan Moore book that Doc would never probably enjoy would be From Hell, because if you don't like artwork where you can't immediately tell what's going on all the time, I think you'd find it far too stylized for your taste. Although they're recolouring it. Do you know about that, Simon?
Recolouring what? Sorry?
They're colouring in From Hell.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Blimey. Okay.
Which, I mean, the artist himself is doing it, I think.
Okay. Oh, well, that makes a difference. I was going to say one Alan Moore book to recommend. I've only read the first volume, actually, because somebody recommended it to me, and it is absolutely stunning, is Promethea.
Oh, right. Okay.
If you like clean artwork, it is technically just, it's absolutely stunning. It's Bolland standard stuff.
Mm.
Really good.
I'll have to check that out.
I think it's interesting what I was saying about As Great as Iron Legion Looks, Starbeast is the more interesting story. I think it's interesting that... I don't think that Iron Legion was originally pitched for the Doctor Who TV series.
Was it?
And while it would have looked brilliant...
It wouldn't have looked terrible.
I don't think the story would have been that fascinating. I mean, effectively, you'd have lots of brilliant scenes, like, I don't know, the Colosseum or something, and then you get the final surprise where the Emperor's mother turns out to be an alien. bit like School for Scandal, what am I talking about? School Reunion. Whereas something like the Star Beast, there's far more meat story-wise to get in, I find.
But yeah, this story, City of the Damned as well, that could have been a 2000 AD story, couldn't it? Very easily, almost without having the Doctor in it.
Long live emotion!
Yes. And there's a lot of the same sort of humour in it as well, isn't there?
Well, I think Dave Gibbons, for me, is someone who's... It was like a window into the next stage of comic books for me, because I grew up with the Beano being the big one for me, and bought it on a weekly basis.
Oh, well, me too. Were you ever a member of the Dennis the Menace fan club?
Unofficially.
Unofficially? I don't think that counts.
I found a Nasher badge once at school and sort of took it home and really? Thought, right, well, I'm part of the club now. So that furry, goggly-eyed Nasher badge that they gave away for it.
So jammy, I've lost mine. No, I really have. I've still got my Dennis one somewhere. It's rusting up. But
Let me have a look at it now.
They still make them, you know? Yeah, the Beano artists came to our local library and... my daughters went, and they both came home with Nasher badges.
Well, this one, fabulous. This one has got a name on the back. I can't tell from its terribly childish handwriting. This is Jean-Marc. There must have been a French exchange student, so it wasn't yours, Mark.
No. Can I just say quickly to all members of the Dennis the Menace fan club who are listening, ding. Thank you.
So is that ding or bing?
Ding.
What does that mean?
I'm not telling you. You're not a member of the fan club.
Oh, you rotter!
It means your pot noodle's ready.
Yeah, and so grew up in the 90s reading four magazines in general, I'd say. I mean, it was mainly DWM and the Beano early on. And then I went on to Simpsons Comics and bought the comics and then ended sort of giving up and buying the graphic novels instead. Just using sort of Christmas money and what have you for that. Christmas presents, birthday presents and whatnot. And then about sort of the mid-noughties, I remember, I think it was around the time the Watchmen film was in production, I think. And I went round my friend's house and he had the graphic novel. And he said, oh, you might want to borrow this. So I did. And I thought it was incredible, actually. I thought it was a real...
Oh, it is.
That along with Batman, with the Batman comics like The Killing Joke... Year One, The Long Halloween, The Cult. Ugh. They were sort of my first foray into Batman as well. And it was a more adult way of storytelling through the form of comic strip. And I didn't really think that comics could be like that. You know, could be very visceral and violent. You know, I always thought they were Dennis throwing an ice cream and walk to the softy's face and the speech bubble saying chortle as he points and laughs at him. You know, I didn't think it could be things like... Dr. Manhattan and his huge blue wang, let's say, for example. I think Dave Gibbons' artwork was an entry point into the next phase of buying these comic strips and these graphic novels and enjoying them in a way that eclipsed how I looked at them as a kid, actually, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew he was a Doctor Who comic strip artist until I watched the Strips for Action DVD, which must have been, I can't remember which one that was on now for the Fourth Doctor, but when he was talking... And then, again, nothing twigged until he mentioned on that he did Watchmen. Might have been the Fifth Doctor one, actually. I can't remember if it was that or if it was the Fifth Doctor one when he says, oh, and left Marvel and went on to do Watchmen. And I thought, oh, blimey, he did Watchmen. You know, and that's really a sort of sit up and take notice moment in that documentary. But yeah, I think his artwork lends something which I don't think the show could do at that point, and that is Doctor Who on an infinite budget. You know, making the world seem a lot bigger than what it was on telly. Mm. And I suppose around the time that the Iron Legion was coming out, you've got stories like Nightmare of Eden, when there are people sitting in rain macks wearing ski goggles, you know. And this is a different world, this. And this is actually that era of comics I prefer to what was going out on TV at the time, I have to say.
There's that scene, isn't there, with the... Isn't there a sweet shop owner or something like that, an old guy?
Yeah.
Gets killed. That frame of him looking afraid of was amazing. Yeah.
They're coming.
Oh, they're coming. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's kind of an upgrade for comics, really, because up to that point, we just had the annuals and TV 21 and things like that, where it had been kind of half, with the exception of the old Dalek strips, it kind of all been a bit half-hearted, isn't it? That it was the artist had kind of watched Doctor Who once or something like that and weren't using reference picks. And then and here, all of a sudden, the Doctor actually looks like the Doctor and the TARDIS is in proportion. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, it wasn't just an entry point for you, I think, Hayden. I think it was an entry point for Doctor Who to be taken seriously. And in that respect, it kind of mirrors, in some respects, it mirrors later on, I suppose, with the McCoy years and onto the new series, where it's all of a sudden treated as a something more than just a kid's show, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of those early comic strips being 10 years before their time, definitely.
Mm. I think as well, getting back to what Simon said about them showing the dead shopkeeper, there's a lot more death in these comic strips. There's a lot more melancholy as well, I think. Especially once you get past the Wagner Mills and you start getting into the Steve Parkhouse era.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, the violence, the Dogs of Doom strip, which leads into a Dalek story as well. The Doctor's got a new companion, which is a hypnotised werewolf soldier who claws and tears people to pieces. And the Doctor basically sets him on people and says, "Oh no! Look, there's loads of soldiers down there. Can you get rid of them?" And Brill goes tearing off down the corridor to tear them to pieces. And the Doctor's like, "Well, I won't look if you don't mind."
And it's like, Christ. Yeah.
You wouldn't get that on television. I mean, you could argue that's not very Doctorish to do that. He's kind of like a Leela on steroids, I guess. Which is a shame because, in a way, I kind of thought he would have made quite an interesting companion. I quite like the Dog Man.
Well, that's the element of the scope that they could open up with this. And I don't know whether it's down to rights issues or whether it was just down to artistic license, but the Doctor does have new companions in these stories. You know, he has companions who don't appear in the TV series, and some who sort of flitter in and out, especially later on, in and out of the series. And, I mean, I think the Fifth Doctor has a few very interesting ones, and then of course arguably the greatest ever is of course Frobisher. But again, we'll probably come on to him.
That's definitely one thing I noticed, was once Pat Mills and John Wagner had stopped writing and they've got Steve Parkhouse in, you do suddenly notice the strip taking a bit of a downturn. Well, it sort of goes off into the realms of fantasy a bit more, and it's full of a lot more melancholy. Although still quite funny, but there's the end of the line story, isn't there? Where the
Doctor
finds these people in a city who are called the Guardian Angels, and they're basically, it's like a gang of decent people who are all being hunted down by this gang of cannibals. And he tries to help them get an old tube train going because they found a way out of the city. And they say it goes out into the countryside, this tube train. So if we get this tube train going, it's our one way out to freedom and beautiful fresh air and everything. And so the Doctor helps them escape. I think only three of them actually managed to survive to get on the train. And then the Doctor helps them get the train off. Then he hops in his TARDIS and sets the coordinates to go out in the countryside. And it's just as ruined by pollution and devastation as everywhere else that he's seen in the city so far. And there's acid rain and there's no crops growing. There's nothing there. And he sits there at this little platform next to the train station waiting for their train to come through. And it just never comes. And he just goes, "Oh, well, they're probably not coming then." Gets in his TARDIS and goes.
Yeah, it's a precursor to The Walking Dead, that. Yeah, that's the vibe I got from that. It was very Walking Dead. It is true, though. But I have to say, Mark, I mean, I've read these on and off over the last 10 years, these early Doctor Who comic strips, because obviously they started releasing the graphic novel compilations, didn't they?
Yes.
But I never had the Fifth Doctor one, any of the Fifth Doctor stories. I'd always heard about The Stars Fell Over Stockbridge and The Tides of Time. And I have to say, I really, really enjoyed those. And possibly, for actual storytelling, I possibly enjoyed them the most out of... I mean, I think the art starts to change, doesn't it? Because I think Dave Gibbons left after The Stars Fell on Stockbridge. And then John Ridgway comes in. But I think the perfect marriage for Doctor Who comics is Steve Parkhouse and Dave Gibbons for me.
Yeah, I would probably agree, although I'm a big fan of John Ridgway as well. So
Yes, yeah, he's very good, actually.
John Ridgway.
One thing I noticed, because I kind of walked away from Doctor Who Weekly after a fairly early run, I picked up some winter specials and things like that where they had some reprints of stuff.
Right.
But one thing I noticed, I got given a load of monthlies by a friend of mine who'd stopped, and he'd got some of the Peter Davison monthly editions. And one thing I noticed at the end of Neutron Nights, well, I suppose, you must have got the tail end of the Tom Baker. So,
yes.
Yeah, the tail end of the Neutron Nights, where you get that thing where Merlin appears at the end and then tells the Doctor that he's going to see him again. But you know it's the last Tom Baker story. So I don't think that's ever happened before, where you've got that overlap, that kind of, you know, that's predating the Watcher as far as there being some kind of, almost like, what's the word?
Foreboding, perhaps.
Foreboding, exactly. And you know that Merlin is going to appear again in the Peter Davison story, and there's that overlap where the two mesh together. I think that is really, psychologically, for a kid, that was really exciting.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And of course, Peter Davison coming in, and then even Dave Gibbons can't quite get him right. He's definitely the Doctor that people have most trouble drawing.
Yes, absolutely. On Strict Fraction, there's that bit. Have you seen the Strict Fraction for the Fifth Doctor?
A while ago, yeah.
Yeah, there's Dave Gibbons on that says that he had complaints from both Peter Davison and Peter Davison's agent after the first issue of The Tides of Time went out. So he got some more photos. He got a few more photos, but not a lot. In the end, they still weren't happy. So he said, well, look, can I come around and photograph Peter? So basically, they got Peter in his outfit, and Dave Gibbons just came around and took loads of photographs of Peter Davison with his head in various positions and different expressions on his face. And you can tell, because definitely the likeness really improves as those strips go on.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that it all stops with just after the stars fell on Stockbridge.
There's a panel in The Tides of Time where Peter Davison looks like an angry thumb. Just wanted to say that. It just makes me laugh. It's just like this frowning thumb with like wispy blonde hair.
I saw one frame earlier on today where he looked like Harry Redknapp. Unfortunately, I didn't take a screenshot. So,
I think it's interesting what you say. I've just been glancing at that 1996 yearbook.
Oh, yes.
Hayden for Starbeast 2. I think it's interesting that in 1979... You know, Winter of Discontent, just about to turn into Thatcher's years. Fudge is sort of a rebellious kid on a council estate. Mm. And in 1996, just about to go into the Blair years, he's suddenly a very sort of smooth, sharp-suited middle manager.
Oh, I wonder what happened there then.
Do I hear the horn of Rassilon blowing?
Oh.
Who fancies stepping out of Doctor Who to talk about a non-Doctor Who comic genre?
I think maybe Simon should, actually. I feel like I've talked to all of you tonight, mate. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm just trying to think what to talk about, really, because Mark's already mentioned the crossover caper from Excalibur, which I would rate as one of my favourite eras of any comic, of a partnership of Chris Claremont and Alan Davis. But I've also begun to really go back to things like the early Tank Girl comics, so Jamie Hewlett, and Alan Grant, is that right? I try and remember the writers of Tank Girl. But for me as an artist, that's kind of stuff I was really inspired with at the time. I mean, again, that's going back to the same kind of time of when I was at college. So that's late 80s, early 90s, of seeing people do something, some of the stuff in that Deadline magazine, which is taking the 2000 AD ethic and then pushing it into kind of music, proper kind of teenage youth culture, and being quite irreverent and having loads of swear words. And one thing I loved about those early strips was that Jamie Hewlett would pick a soundtrack for each story. So there'd be a little box which would say art by Jamie Hewlett, story by blah blah blah, soundtrack, and then it would say Big Audio Dynamite number 10 Upping Street or something like that. And it was like all the senseless things and people like that, so you knew what record to put on while you were reading it, which I just thought was brilliant. And I've not seen anyone else quite do that the same way. And of course, he's come through all the way to working with Gorillaz and things like that. And he's well worth following on Instagram as well, for some of the artwork he's coming out with. It's just gorgeous. He's really
Alan
involved.
Martin you're thinking of?
Sorry? Alan Martin. Yes. Yes, Alan Martin. So, I mean, that's kind of the two sides of my influences, is you've got people like Alan Davis, who I just think everything he draws is pretty much a masterpiece. But then the other end of the scale is somebody like Jamie Hewlett, where it's a little bit more slapdash. I remember going into Forbidden Planet in about 1990, and they had these big, you know, those poster frames that you flip through that are upright, but they're like, you know, sort of waist height, and you flip through them. And they had original artwork, and they had a big original, you know, A3 piece of original Tank Girl artwork. And of course, being a poor student, didn't have any money. But I just stood there for 5 minutes looking at it, looking at all the places where it had been tip-exed and stuff pasted over the top. Of course, it was all black and white, and all the Letraset toning, you know, where you get the dotty kind of shading or what have you, is all cut out by hand and put into place. So, you know, you could have done a brass rubbing on it and you would have seen a different picture. So that was amazing. And if we're talking about my influences, the other big one for me is Jamie Hernandez and the Love and Rockets comics as well, which, again, you can take any frame of those books and it's a piece of art. You could frame it. Just really amazing and really clean as well. And just it just looks like perfection. Will that do?
Mm. Yeah. I have to say, yeah, that's one of the lovely things about seeing original artwork, isn't it? That's been, you know, comic artwork when it's on the board. Like you say there, you can see all the Tipex and you can see all the, like, there's some bits. I've got a couple of, do you know John Hicklinson, who's now passed away?
Oh, no, no.
He drew, as far as me and Doc are concerned, he drew later Nemesis stories.
Okay.
Do you know Nemesis the Warlock, yes?
Yes, yeah.
I've got a couple of pieces of that because he used to live locally. He died a few years ago, unfortunately. He died very young. But his dad used to come into town. This is while the artist was still alive. And used to set up a store and sell his son's original 2000D artwork off. And I think I bought two pieces which were like about 30 quid each, which is absolute buttons these days.
Mark, in the same way that the guitar man from the Suite who lived locally once saw you and then went to a neighbour and just said, oh, I've just seen Bob Geldof.
Yeah, walking his dog. Yeah.
Does this guy see you with your beard and say to a neighbour, oh, I've just seen Alan Moore?
Well, I have to say my hair has got and beard has got quite a lot longer since lockdown, but it's still not, it hasn't got to Alan Moore-like proportions yet.
Is anyone planning to talk about, I mean, other than you have already, Marvel-related?
Yes, yes.
Shall we turn and have a look at the Fifth Doctor era in Doctor Who Weekly Magazine Monthly? Who was going to do this?
I was going to talk about this, I think.
Right, well, don't forget, guys, that Mark's brain is windmill-powered and needs a blast of air to operate. So pass us the bellows, please, Hayden.
Right, there
you go. All got a pair of bellows each. Okay, let's get him going.
Windy Miller, Windy Miller.
Fire away, Mark.
So going back to what I was saying earlier, I think this is a real leap forward in terms of narrative. And I think it really benefits from the change of Doctor. Because a lot of Steve Parkhouse's stuff is a lot more thoughtful. No offence to Pat Mills and John Wagner. A lot of Steve Parkhouse's stuff, I feel, is a lot deeper emotionally. And I think it deals a lot with the internal and the interior and the human mind in a way that I don't think is necessarily possible with the Fourth Doctor, because he's kind of too, I'm the Fourth Doctor, la-di-da, da-di-da, and blustering through everything. Whereas I think the Fifth Doctor's a much more pensive and lacking in confidence.
He does come across as quite goofy, the Fourth Doctor, in those strips, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think it's that double chin they give the Fourth Doctor as well.
Oh, I know.
Like, really goofy. Yeah, the Fourth Doctor's very much his, you can tell it's Tom Baker and the Fourth Doctor, but it does sort of morph into, it's not the TV Doctor, if you know what I mean. Whereas I feel, actually, the Fifth Doctor does feel closer to the TV version. both in looks once Dave Gibbons has got his photographs done, and also just in vibe. There's a lot of, how was it, Peter Davison said he wanted to do his character. I know he said he wanted to do his, or somebody suggested he should be like
Tristan but Brave.
Tristan but Brave, yeah, from All Creatures Great and Small. But also, didn't he say he wanted to bring in sort of vulnerability because he felt that the Fourth Doctor had seemed too invulnerable?
Yeah.
And I think they do that really well in the strip, because there's loads of moments where this Doctor almost crumples and is terrified and is afraid and is paranoid. And at one point, when he finds out that he's actually left his own universe and he's in an alternate universe, he just walks into the sea and tries to drown himself.
Yeah. Which isn't, yeah, he does, doesn't he?
Yeah. He just like, that's it, I've had enough. I mean, I'm not surprised, to be honest, because he's had some quite mind-bending and difficult... I mean, it's nothing compared to what we're going to get to in a little bit. But, I mean, The Tides of Time, that first story that runs on from Neutron Nights, for me, that's not actually my favourite. I find that almost... See, I like the visuals of it, and I like the kind of madcap nature of it. I love the character Shade who gets introduced. I always loved Shade when I was a kid. I thought he was incredibly cool.
Mm.
And I used to draw him in my... I used to draw him in my notebooks and stuff for years afterwards. But yeah, for me, Tides of Time's... Oh, it's strange, isn't it? The Timeless Children, we say, that was irritating with its changing of canon, with it saying all the doctors, you know, any doctor can be canon, or what people claim, and the doctor isn't from Gallifrey, they've got a whole new mysterious beginning, the first doctor wasn't the first doctor. You think, oh, it's just too much messing around with canon. But in here, I mean, obviously the comics aren't canon, so you kind of let it go, their own thing. But you've got the keyboard of harmony that's played to keep the world in order, and it's like... The nearest we've got to it before, I think, in Doctor Who is early on when the Fourth Doctor in the comic strip ends up like with the Greek gods at some point, which is rather bizarre. And that's Steve Parkhouse as well, isn't it? And this time, so it's kind of like, so there's this keyboard which keeps order and stops chaos reigning in the universe that's played by the Prime Mover and some demonic force called the Melanicus comes down and takes control of this keyboard and starts sowing absolute chaos throughout time. And then Merlin has to get involved with Rassilon, because Rassilon turns up as well. And I have to say, the Doctor, I don't think, does anything really in this story. It's either Shade or it's just in the night. And the Doctor pretty much just wanders around looking baffled and a bit lost and takes Justin and Shade wherever they need to be, and eventually the Melanicus is defeated. I mean, there's some lovely weird scenes where the TARDIS ends up in the bath with a rubber duck.
Yeah,
it goes down the plug hole, doesn't it?
And then Shade stood there, a massive Shade, well, who's life size to the bath, just reaches in, pulls the plug out, and the miniature TARDIS and the duck both disappear down the plug hole and then end up on a shooting range at a fairground. And I just think, oh, that's fantastic, I love it. But he doesn't.
But you can't start saying, oh, this is anything, unless you take it as being like. Not the time meddler.
Mind robber.
Like the mind robber.
Mm.
Where he's effectively landed in a land of fiction. But you're right about the keyboard thing. It, as great as it is, you have to start saying, well, you know, any idea of canon. Because essentially that's, you're saying, hang on, well, where does this all come from? That's a brilliant idea. But it sort of takes...
Well, it's like that's become a god type character.
Yes. And then once that strip's ended, we never hear from him again.
Mm.
But he's so powerful. And it almost makes you think, well, in that case, everything that happens from then on, or at any time, the Doctor is partly driven by this guy, tootling away on his organ, if you'll excuse the expression. So it's interesting, but then...
I would say my favourite story would be Stars Fell Over Stockbridge.
Yeah, mine too.
Which is only little one. But compared to the Tides of Time, it's absolutely streamlined.
Mm.
Tides of Time feels messy to me, and it feels like a glorious ride, the Tides of Time. But ultimately, I don't know what it means or where I've been.
Mm.
Whereas Stars Fell Over Stockbridge is a wonderful story about a little human life that Maxwell Edison, who's an outcast in his local village of Stockbridge. Everyone thinks he's mad. And he ends up in an adventure with a doctor where all that happens is he gets in the doctor's TARDIS, they go and look at a spaceship, then the doctor comes back down, drops him off, and the spaceship explodes. Technically, physically, that's all that really happens as far as you're aware, isn't it? Which is a very thin plot. But it's what the script puts in there. They go up onto that spaceship, and I remember reading it as a kid and always finding it's claustrophobic. It feels stifling, even though they're on a massive, enormous spaceship that they can get lost on. There's nothing living on it. It's just a completely empty hulk, as far as they're aware. And Edison just starts going mad, absolutely overcome with fear and panic and a sense of foreboding. And he ends up, the doctor loses him. And then when the doctor finds him again and sort of gets him to pull himself together, and he says, no, look, there's nothing on here. Look, there's nothing behind this wall, because Maxwell Edison's convinced that there's some horror behind the wall. So the doctor says, no, there's nothing there. And they open this, basically cuts a hole in this wall, and a massive blast of air comes out, and that's it, pretty much. They go, oh, that's right, there's nothing there. And then that's when the doctor drops him off. And he also, and Maxwell Edison says, oh, when's the ship going to burn up when it enters the Earth's atmosphere? And he tells everyone locally. And so everyone looks out their window at that time, and they see the ship burning up, and they see the stars falling on Stockbridge. And suddenly Maxwell Edison is a local hero for a little while. And for once, he's been proven right, and he's not Mad Max. And it's lovely. But it's just that bit where they're on the ship and they're feeling...
Yeah, Tides of Time is very much sort of very broad brush space opera-y type of thing, isn't it? Where it's a real page turner. Whereas with Starsville and Stocksbridge, you're not really quickly turning the next page to see what happens next. You're more sort of reading it slowly and thinking about it.
Oh, yes.
Aren't you? And then it's neatly tied up at the end with the, and stars did end up falling on Stockbridge.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right with that. It is one where you take it in and you read each panel quite slowly, and it's like a savoury dish as opposed to the sweet sugar rush of Tides of Time, and you do want to savour it.
It's not the umami of Lunar Lagoon. I don't think I'd ever got beyond the Fourth Doctor cartoons. I might have glanced at the odd one of these. But I think I possibly stopped buying Doctor Who Weekly by this time. And I was watching Fifth Doctor Strip for Action DVD in preparation for this. And I thought, and they talked about, oh, it's six strips over about 25 issues. And they're almost all, you know, one leading into the other. And I thought, wow, I'm quite excited to read that. And I love Tides of Time. I like that sort of mad... metaphysical nonsense. Loved the cricket ball turning into the grenade.
Yeah, I like that.
And then made even better by the grenade turning into a cricket ball during the First World War.
Oh, yes.
But I loved that Star Cell and Stockbridge thing. It's not something where you're going to think, oh my, what an amazing roller coaster of a story. But it's a lovely little vignette. See, I think I actually saw it accidentally while I was bringing it up. That very final frame, and stars fell on Stockbridge, and I thought even without reading it, oh, I quite like that. But that's going to be a really nice story. That Stockbridge Horrors leads on from that, isn't it? It's that fire god, the thing that gets released from that spaceship.
Yeah, basically, it's the elemental force. It ends up taking over the spaceship. I mean, I love the Stockbridge Horror as well. It's just Stockbridge Horror suffers. Badly.
Of course, it's the buried TARDIS thing, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Which I mentioned during the Jadoon review. Yeah, there's that sense that because we find out later that the doctors basically hang around in Stockbridge because he's got a feeling that something's up. So although it looks like he's just having a quiet time in the English countryside, fishing and playing cricket, he's actually looking for clues and stuff quietly. But he leaves the TARDIS alone for ages, and it's only when he sees the TARDIS that there's a quarry blows up, and in, what's it, 500 million year old rock or something, there's the imprint of the TARDIS, and it makes it into the paper. And the Doctor runs off to go and see the TARDIS and sees it is covered in mud from that quarry, so it has been in primordial mud or whatever. It's quite shocking, that. There's that beautiful scene where the Doctor says, "Have you been going out without me?" And the TARDIS just they've lettered it, and there's just a little warp sound effect with a question mark on the end of it. It looks like, "Are you lying to me?" See, that's quite dark as well. I mean, a lot of these stories, like I said before, there's a strong vein of melancholy that comes through them. I think there's a lot of sense of loss and the feel that the Doctor's struggling to keep his grip on things, which, like I say, wouldn't work as well with the boisterous, chummy Fourth Doctor.
Well, because we move here, don't we, from Dave Gibbons stops drawing with the Star Trek on Stockbridge, and it moves to Mick Austin. And for me, the Stockbridge horror is enough of a story to keep me wanting to watch it. When they start moving into Lunar Lagoon and Four Dimensional Vistas and The Moderator, I lose interest in the stories. And the Mick Austin's artwork, where everyone seems to be very squat, they're all like fairly slim Sontarans. You know, the TARDIS always looks broader than it is tall. So do half the characters. I found it harder to read then. The story wasn't particularly engaging me, and the artwork wasn't particularly engaging me.
No.
So having watched those first three stories, Tides of Time and the two Stockbridges, I was a little disappointed by the final three.
Yeah, I think they say on that Stripped Fraction, don't they, that Gus, the American fighter pilot who they pick up, is something of a female Tegan. Not a female Tegan.
A female Tegan.
Yeah, it's more, he's more ladylike than Tegan.
I was going to say, I quite like Mick Austin's artwork, but I know what you're saying with the proportions. I think the line work is gorgeous because it's so different from all the others. It's quite kind of brushy.
What does that mean? Line work?
As in the marks on the page.
Oh, right.
But I was quite a big,
so the bleeding obvious then.
when about this time, I wasn't reading a lot of Doctor Who Monthly. I was well into my Marvel, but I was seeing Mick Austin's work. He used to do a lot of the cover artwork for a lot of the reprinted, you know, Spider-Man and Captain America at the time, and he did some really gorgeous poster artwork. But then I guess he was basing his proportions and everything on existing drawings of superheroes. So his proportions were always pretty good. But everyone looks like the Meddling Monk, don't they? In the Doctor Who comics. So I quite like them. But that, again, it was in this pile of comics that his friend gave to me. So I was able to do a bit of catch up. What I thought was interesting is that the Stockbridge Horror is drawn. It's drawn by Steve Parkhouse.
Written by him.
Oh, really?
And Mick Austin's done the inking. So Steve Parkhouse has done the pencils, and then Mick Austin's gone in and done the line work.
Perhaps it's maybe too much of a shock to go straight from Dave Gibbons' style to Mick Austin's style.
Yeah, maybe so.
Of, you know, the excellent draftsman to, shall we say, the slightly more quirky approach.
Did Mick Austin do the artwork for that Zygon backup story?
Oh, maybe. I can look it up.
Is it something 7, Sky 4 7?
I think he did. That really rings a bell. Skywatch 7, yes, he did. With Steve Parkhouse.
Yeah, because there's a single page spread of his work. Well, I'd say there's a single frame where he's... what do you call it when it's just one picture on the page?
Splash page.
Oh, splash page, yeah.
Yeah, there's a... Thank you. I knew there was a word for it. My brain just wouldn't bloody produce it. It was hiding it from me.
Bellows, guys. Get the bellows going.
Thank you. Yeah, a splash page of a Zygon at a door, and it looks amazing. It's a bit of a dark picture. Hold on, here we are. I'll just... this picture here.
Oh, that one, yeah, Zygon.
Oh, right. Oh, yes. Now, that does ring a bell, that. As the guy I was saying, oh, my.
Now, he's a great artist, actually, because when I was at college and we did a field trip to London, and as part of that, there were a group of about three of us who had decided halfway through our graphic design course that we wanted to be illustrators instead. But our tutor was really open-minded, and he said, if you want to go off and do a couple of things while you're in London that kind of relate to what you're trying to do, then go for it. And we did a trip to the 2000 AD offices where I met Alan McKenzie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is that a King's Reach Tower?
Yeah, yeah. We were supposed to be in there for 20 minutes while they had their lunch break, and we ended up being in there for an hour, which was really nice, just chatting to them. Can't remember who the editor was at the time. Was it David?
Remember
something?
What year that was?
Dave Bishop.
About 1989 or 90, one of the two.
1989 or 90.
Yeah.
While you were visiting them in the King's Reach Tower, I would have been sitting in an office block across the road from it, just staring gloomily out of the window.
Are you kidding?
You know.
Well, I never.
It took me ages. I worked there for years, and it's only after I left it to work in another office a few years, it suddenly occurred to me, that's the King's Reach Tower. Class dark spaceships I've been walking past every morning.
Well, I never. It wasn't particularly glamorous, if I remember rightly. I don't...
No.
All I remember is these piles of artwork where people had kind of sent in their artwork, and they hadn't got round to looking at it yet. You know, they were very straight down the line and very realistic about what you needed to do to be able to get into comics. But... aside from that, the other thing we did was we went to see a couple of agents, and one of the agents I found, there was I can't remember the name of it, it was a handbook that gets put out, a directory that gets put out every year. Is it the artist yearbook? I think it is, where they give a list of agents, artist agents. And we went to the one because I recognised the name Mick Austin. So we went to see Mick Austin's agent in London, who gave us loads of advice and what have you. So there's another little link.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. That was the same trip where I saw the Tank Girl artwork in Forbidden Planet. So that was a great weekend.
So you actually got to meet them?
Yeah.
Did you just walk in or...?
No, I had a very persuasive friend who phoned up and tried to get them when he said that we were actually students on a course and what have you. They were a bit more accommodating because I don't think they let anyone just go in. So, it was good. So I met Tharg.
I think that might have been Dave Bishop. Was it did he have glasses?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I remember him being quite a stocky guy. Fairly tall, dark hair.
Like balding and thin is what I was thinking. So.
No. Alan McKenzie was the sub-editor.
Oh, what's his name? It wasn't Steve McManus, was it?
Oh, it might have been. Now you say that.
Because he was sort of editor on and off for years there.
In fact, that that office block I'd have been sitting in was the original IPC headquarters. So they built a more modern one across the road. Let's see. Pat Mills, 1977, editors. Kelvin Gosnell, 77-78. Steve McManus, 78-87. Richard Burton, 87-94.
Oh, it would have been Richard
Alan
Burton.
Alan McKenzie, 1994.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. But I think Steve McManus is probably still around, but maybe it wasn't him. I know they packed him off to America at one point.
In fact, wasn't Richard Burton the inspiration for Bert?
Oh!
The script robot of Thugs.
Oh, quite possibly, yeah.
Oh, that's... God. Right, where were we? How did we get on to Simon going into... when you were at college?
Mick Austin.
Oh, that was it, right.
But I do love those strips and... just trying to remember. I'm wondering whether one of the artists did the artwork in the Doctor Who Easter egg, the one and only Doctor Who Easter egg in those times. Did anyone else get the Peter Davison Easter egg?
Oh, the one that looks a bit suspect when you open the door up.
That's yeah. And it had more transfers in it.
Woohoo! I have to tell you, I would kill for transfers when I was a kid, though. I absolutely loved them. They were my favourite thing. But sadly, no, I didn't have that Easter egg.
Oh.
For sort of pressing onto dioramas, or for pressing onto what?
Oh, no, for pressing onto, yeah, diorama. You know, onto backgrounds.
I used to do that quite a lot.
Thinking about it, I think there was a miniature comic inside the Easter egg. It was about A6 size or something like that. It was tiny. Whether you put the transfers in there, I can't remember.
Right, I think we've said a lot already, and there's a fair bit we've got left to say. Shall we make this into a two-parter?
That sounds like a brilliant idea.
Close this one down and do another one next week.
I think that would be wise.
Hmm.
You okay with that, Simon?
Yeah, absolutely. I can come back.
In that case, let's do a bit of closing down admin, and then we'll say farewell. Right, just got a few messages, a few late items of news coming in. Oh dear. You know our local drive-through burger bar down the road? Apparently, with this little heat wave we're having at the moment, the surface of their car park's all melting, it's all getting tacky. Oh dear.
Mm.
What else is happening? Oh dear. I think the coronavirus effect on the economy is starting to bite. You know our local branch of IKEA?
Mm.
They've just announced they're having to shut their skating rink.
Oh, what a shame.
And we've had a final message from the senior chef robot in our kitchens. He's just finished tidying away. He's asking if he can throw away all the paperwork. Yeah, you can throw it away now if you like. Okay. Hang on. So we've got the cake. Where is it? Where's the cake? You scoffed it all. Did I or did I not, at the start of this podcast, say that we had to leave a slice for Lorraine, the barmaid at the Whisk and Plunger? You greedy boys. You are greedy. How are we going to get assured of decent service next time we go for a pint? Everything just happens in threes, doesn't it, to save people trouble? McDonald's car park's melting all its tar. That Swedish ice rink's closing down. And now no one's left some cake out for Lorraine.
No.
I don't think I can take it.
It took so long to bake it.
Oh no, listen to that. Coming from the kitchen. We'll never have that recipe again.
Oh no.
Right, oh, here come the Sons of Skaro to cheer us up. Dalek Skaros, is that message in your hand the latest update from the World Health Organization?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump babies into the river.
Dalek Ray, Dalek Ray. We have unmasked shoppers in aisle 27.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone. See you next time for part two.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Cheers.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.